This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
The title of the book, The Silent Thought, America in Crisis. And the author is Charlie Wirz, and Charlie joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, how are you today?
Great to have you with us. America in Crisis. I think most people would see America's having big problems, and you're proposing that we as Americans, we're the ones to step forward and just not just think about it, but to do something. But, you know, a lot of people don't know quite what to do with their thoughts, do they? Or they forget them and they don't pay attention even to themselves, the importance of their thoughts.
That's very true. The opening segments of the book, the first couple of chapters, deal with just that. For example, the first chapter deals with spontaneous thought, and second chapter is more regarding targeted thought. And this is not to be overly technical writing. It's more to provoke and get a discussion going with my readers about what thought is all about as it relates to everyday experiences, and whether or not we act on those thoughts or feel they're necessary to act on, and how they come into our consciousness.
How would you say the media controls our thinking?
Well, I think to a great deal, if we're one that simply relies on quick sound bites and absorbs those without any critical thought analysis, we become very susceptible to what the media has to say. And then it's a question of the choices we make in terms of which media, whether it be print or electronic media, whether it's the internet or whether it's the news media itself via cable and broadcast channels.
So when we talk about silent thought, one phrase comes to my mind very quickly, the silent majority, and I guess that is really the same thing, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it's so. I mean, I think that we have gotten ourselves into a mindset as Americans that we leave the critical decisions, the important decisions, to a small few, primarily, the book is more tailored to what is occurring in Washington, D.C., as it relates to our national politicians. So we leave those thinking that it's going to be just fine with a small few, instead of remembering that it's up to every American to be part of that process in different ways, of course.
Now, you've already mentioned spontaneous thought. That's your first chapter. Your second chapter is targeted thought. Let's talk a little bit about what you mean by spontaneous versus targeted. Let's start with spontaneous.
Well, I think what I mean by spontaneous is that we sit, and I give some examples. We might be sitting in a coffee shop, for example, and we're just sitting there. We might be reading, we might be writing, and we're really interacting with all of those triggers that hit our consciousness, as well as we might see other people, hear other conversations, overhear other conversations. So throughout our day, even through our work day, we are exposed to a lot of thought triggers that create spontaneous thought. And that's just what it is. And that sometimes is very fleeting. We sometimes try to, I mentioned in the book that sometimes we have a thought and then we think to ourselves, wow, this is powerful. This means a lot. And then before you know it, it's no longer resides in our consciousness. And we wonder, what was that thought? And I know right. It was good, but I just can't remember exactly what it was.
Boy, if I don't write it down, it's gone. I know that.
Right.
So then targeted thought.
Well, targeted thought is what I try to relate this to as I move through the book and then take this concept or take this concern and talk about what I believe are the five major crises facing our country. I look at targeted thought and try to connect that to how this affects these crises. And targeted thought, in my mind, is really through the either direct or indirect actions of others. You mentioned the media, for example. I believe the media is very much involved in targeting our thought. Now, one of the things I mentioned is, for example, advertisement, which is not a big problem, but so you don't have a problem necessarily. The people that are trying to sell a product or a service, they are targeting your thought. So if you pick up a newspaper and you see advertisements, that's usually what's happening there. But if you pick up a newspaper and you're, for example, reading an article that is biased in some way, well, the reality behind that is it's actually trying to target your thought and for a particular purpose, whether it's whatever bias it might have or whatever it's trying to accomplish. So the whole idea is to be able to understand what the target of thought is, that meaning what is someone trying to accomplish by that, or if you're within a group of people or you're listening to someone on a TV program, which is supposedly a news program, but yet you're hearing things that are trying to target you in a way to get you to absorb it and not only agree to it. So that's a lot of what the Targeted Thought chapter is about.
And today, at this moment in time, with this upcoming presidential election, a lot of efforts to target our thoughts, to convince us one way or another. And so you're saying there's never been a more critical time for us to re-examine our thinking, our thoughts.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And one of the reasons being that we are in a presidential election year, and I really believe America is at a crossroads in a lot of different ways, and that's the reason behind identifying what I believe are major crises in this country. So it's okay for a politician, for example, to target a thought. We want them to tell us what they believe, what they stand for. But we also want to, we should believe in the fact that we do have the discipline and a lot of time to understand whether or not that targeted thought is valid, and what we're listening to has merit or doesn't have merit. But there's no question that, and again, you're also targeted in a highly charged political year such as this one by people who support a particular candidate. And let's just talk about the presidency. So you have people on both sides of that trying to target your thought and get you to believe a certain way in order to secure your vote.
Your book focuses on, as you've already pointed out, five crises in America. Let's just talk a couple of those, all the time we have, just to focus in on a couple. American crisis number one, it's chapter three, leadership in America. Share some things with us.
Well, again, I think everyone should set their expectations very high when it comes to our leaders. But one of the things I try to get into in this chapter is, how do we choose our leaders? And, through life, through childhood, through adulthood, we hopefully have people that we have identified as leaders. And that can change many times. But we want to be sure that leadership has qualities that should be, as I said, a very high threshold. And, for example, the things I talk about in this chapter are, I start with one of the most important positions in our country, and that is our president, and why leadership is so critical to that individual's ability to either enhance America or diminish America. And leadership, the book is tries to be very fair in assessing our current president's behavior as a leader. And I think in some ways it's been not very good. And I try to identify that and trying to get America to believe we should be a nation of leaders and not believe or entrust it into a small group of people, especially those few number of politicians in Washington, D.C.
I think it's so important, at least from my experience, that we as citizens must learn that we can really make a difference. Our thinking is important, our views, our opinions, but we have to gain that confidence to share them, and often to share them in the public arena in front of others, and that's quite challenging for many.
Well, without a doubt, and I think that it does have a lot to do with confidence and conviction. I think that most Americans are leaders in a lot of ways, whether it be family or workplace. But as a country, we can't keep just allowing the so-called leadership through our political process to entrust that's going to happen the right way. Every American has a role to play, some more than others. But first and foremost, and that's why the book started with thought, because you have to first have that thought and that critical analysis and take that time rather than accepting everything as is. And then I talk in the leadership into this chapter about what I believe the critical traits are for a successful leader.
Well, let's talk a little bit about chapter four. That's American Crisis Number Two, Political Correctness. Boy, we hear that PC term all the time.
Right. Exactly. And it may not sound like a crisis, but it certainly is. And I think that the what's creeping into our country is, again, this has to do with thought. In my mind, political correctness is nothing more than a narrow viewpoint by very few people trying to control the thought and speech of others. And I think if the thought process is not critical, not only, as you said, without confidence, you won't really find a way to express it or think you need to express it, and you'd rather simply conform to what a political correctness, mindset might have you conform to. My, we're keeping it very simple, is my litmus test on this is, I think of it in terms of American correctness and what has made this country great. I don't think we should be overly focused on this. And again, this is a term that's developed. This whole political correctness is a very narrow viewpoint in my mind in this country.
I know I have learned a lot by studying the founders of our country and the whole process they went through, and it really inspires anyone who will look into history, because history will repeat itself for good or bad.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that, just speaking of leadership, I think that we don't, and even as everyday Americans, we don't take enough thought and consideration of all the historical value that we have as a country, and continue to build on that and learn from that.
You also cover, I'm just going to read the other crises that you mention. You have American Crisis Number Three, which is Race Relations in America, American Crisis Number Four, Politics in America, and American Crisis Number Five, Open Borders and Immigration. Obviously, all these we hear in the news all the time, and they're very critical issues that have to be not only thought about, but take action upon to make America better, because we as citizens, as you point out, we're so distracted. It's hard to focus, isn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. It's more of a distracted citizenry than it has ever been before. And some of that is because we just don't take the time, and we'd rather preoccupy ourselves with the more enjoyable aspects of life. Politics in general, and I think that in itself is probably why it's one of the most important chapters, is because it really takes a look at how politics affect every aspect of our life. And I think that a lot of Americans don't really believe that. You think of it in the abstract and sort of put it off to the side. Think it'll take care of itself.
Again, the title of the book, The Silent Thought, America in Crisis, and we've been talking to the author, Charlie Wirz. Charlie, what's the best way to get your book?
Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or ArchwayPublishing.com.
Thank you so much, Charlie, so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And this interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Infant care specialist Blythe Lipman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With Baby and Toddler Instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying to 14 ways to get a baby to eat and so much more. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Winnie the Mini Horse. The book is co-authored by mother and daughter team Andra Ebert and Morgan Ebert, who reside in the great state of Illinois in the United States of America. And because Morgan is unable to join us today, Andra's going to step in and take the reins. Welcome, Andra, to the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Jay.
This is well illustrated, and because of the size of the book, 28 pages, my presumption is that your target audience is younger children. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We wanted to bring the story to young children because I think they can relate to it.
Wonderful. This is a book that has a, besides just the entertainment value, what was the motivation behind writing Winnie the Mini Horse? What was the reason you decided to share the story?
Well, it was really twofold. One, both my daughter and I are avid readers, and we really hope that the children share our love of reading. The second point was we wanted to share the importance of therapy animals working in long-term care, Alzheimer's units, veterans homes, schools, hospitals, those kinds of things. Traditionally, it has been smaller animals such as dogs, cats, you know, sometimes birds and things like that. Well, for us, we use American miniature horses as therapy animals. So we actually take the horses into the facilities. So we wanted to share that. It's a relatively new approach to therapy work, and so we wanted to highlight that.
How long have you folks been involved in therapy work with horses and with animals?
Well, with animals, it started way back when Morgan began riding horses. I didn't grow up with horses, so my involvement started when she actually started riding horses. She was about 12 or so, I think. And so it's been quite long-term now, but I had read about this article using miniature horses, and I was fascinated. And so when I retired from work, I talked to my husband, and we decided that we could do this. So I then proceeded to do some more research and hooked up with a gal named Kate Basher in Kansas City and went out, visited her, fell in love with her miniature horses, and a month later I had two of my own. So it's been almost 2 years now.
2 years. And when you say miniature horses, they come in all sizes and shapes from what I have seen. How would you describe the ones that you use in therapy? Are they the more barrel-chested type of minis, or are they the smaller, petites-looking looking horses?
Well, ours are a little bit smaller, and they're actually more slender. They are actually a horse. Their body structure, their bone structure, everything is identical to a horse. It's just miniaturized. So when we're standing, the last hair of their mane, in order to be an A American miniature horse, has to be 34 inches or less.
Wow.
Mine stand at 32, 31, and 30. So they very well meet the criteria. If I'm standing next to them, their head is at my hip, and I'm about 5'6", so that can give you an idea of where they're at.
That's an amazing size. In therapy, using these animals, what kind of response are you getting? Obviously, it's something that is helpful, but have you seen anything that really surprised you even in your use of mini horses with therapy?
Absolutely. There's been instances where you have residents who may not have been verbal for a long time, and they will be verbal with the horses. I had a particular woman that I was visiting, and usually when I'm visiting, I'm down, especially if they're in wheelchairs, try to be about eye level. And so I was trying to engage with her, and she wanted nothing to do with me. She was looking at Bailey, one of my horses. She's a black and white pinto. Mm. And she grabbed Bailey by the face and began talking to her with words that I couldn't necessarily understand. And the staff later told me that she was really nonverbal with the family and staff alone. But she was verbal with Bailey. So the next visit we went on, I tried to get her to talk to the other two horses, and she wanted nothing to do with them. Hmm. It's only Bailey. So it is something with that horse that triggers a response in this woman to be verbal. And that's an amazing thing to watch. Just yesterday, had another woman that really is basically nonverbal, and she mouthed thank you to me.
Wow.
And those are the times I go out and I cry a little bit. I go out to the car, you know, so nobody sees me.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah,
fascinating.
You know, the response that people have, I said, if I could bottle it, I'd be rich. Just the smiles, the engagement. People say, well, what makes a therapy work? That's part of it, is the engagement with something. I have people who normally don't reach out and do anything, try to reach out and pet and touch the animals. That's part of the therapy work that we do.
Incredible thing that you do in your work, your field work. You have decided to write and share the story of Winnie. Describe for my listeners who Winnie is in this story and why she's a key, or he, is it a he or a she?
I'm No, it's a she.
It's a she. Thank you. Why she is the key character, and what makes her different?
Well, the reason we decided to base the story, and hopefully more stories around Winnie, is we got Winnie when she was 4 months old. So she hadn't begun her training yet. So we are taking her from really ground zero to a fully trained therapy horse. So she's going to go through many changes and plateaus and learning experiences, such as walking upstairs, being in elevators. I mean, things you typically don't think with horses. And so we got to talking, my daughter and I, and it was like, you know, that's like kids moving from grade to grade and learning new skills. You know, I have a 9-year-old grandson that all of a sudden goes, oh, we've got to do division. Do you know what division is?
Hmm.
You know, so I'm looking at the new things he's experiencing, and Winnie is experiencing the same things. And so we wanted to follow her growth. When we got her, she was 4 months old. She became part of our herd. We already had two horses. We had Bailey and Jasper, who had been with us for over a year. So it was getting acclimated even to a new family. Sometimes, you know, kids are experiencing half brothers and sisters and stepbrothers and sisters and stepmoms and all sorts of new things. Winnie was experiencing the same thing. She came from her original family. All of a sudden, she's taken away and put in a new family. So she's adjusting to a new family. So even though we're using a horse, there's a lot of themes that go through the story.
I'm gathering from how you've described this that almost, although you may not have intended it to do so, there is an underlying therapy for children who might have special events in their life that they need to cope with.
Absolutely, and we talk about that. When we go to visit schools, when we visit certain places, we talk about, you know, you may be afraid to try something new, but look at Winnie. She was able to do this. So we try to relate it to the kids, absolutely.
Fabulous. The book itself is only 28 pages. Is there an age limit, or is there any child that has read this book that maybe has not responded? What has been the response?
The response has been incredible. We decided early on, Morgan and I did, that when we got the book, we were going to donate books to libraries and schools.
Beautiful.
So we have gone around the entire county. Now, we live in a very small county in Illinois. I think the total population is like 33,000, so we're not very big. But we've visited at least 8 or 9 schools, donated books to their library. And when we do, the teachers are like, they're driving me crazy because everybody wants the book. Because when we go in, Winnie actually hoof prints the book for them.
Really?
So she actually puts her hoof print in the front of the book. So we read the book to the kids. Winnie hoof prints it, and then it's in their library for them to get. And they said, you know, kids are fighting to be able to check out the book, which is wonderful.
That's a beautiful response.
That's what we want.
Oh, that's great. Now, you have a book that is a little bit unique in the children's era. How would you describe it that maybe makes it a little bit different from some of the other books that are trying to attract children's interests?
Well, I think the fact that the character is real, that you actually can follow up in a number of ways. You can follow us on Facebook and actually see her and see her doing the things that we're planning. So I think it makes it very relatable. You can follow along with her. You can go with her progress as she's growing.
This is your first effort as an author. And yes. And I'm understanding that you haven't been put off by the challenge. You have overcome some and were able to get this done. The illustrations, how did that come about and how long did it take?
Oh, it took several months for the illustrations, because what I would do is when I was working with the illustrator, I would send actual pictures, and then she would send me back proofs, and then we would go over them again and maybe send some suggestions. I laugh. Morgan is so particular. At one point, there's a picture of Winnie with a halter on her face, and the halter wasn't correct. Mm. And Morgan goes, I know no one else would know that, but I know that, and most people will know that, so we have to correct that.
Wow.
So it's little details like that. The characters and the horses, you know, we described very clearly, and then sent pictures of them also.
Did the story take very long, or was that something that came together rather quickly?
That actually came together quickly. Morgan sat down, wrote out about 18 different points, and we chose and threw away some, kept some, altered some. I said the most difficult thing is trying to choose your words so carefully, because you have such limited space, to make sure that your idea gets across and that it's relatable. I said, before I always would have thought, oh, it's so easy to write a kid's book, just sit down and whip it out. Well, that's not true.
No, it's not.
It's very demanding and it's very exacting.
What's the moral of your story?
Anyone can do anything. Truly.
Beautiful.
We're taking a horse with absolutely no skills and teaching it to provide a huge service. Anyone else can work on themselves and improve themselves to offer something to other people.
Excellent children's story. The title again is Winnie the Mini Horse, with co-authors mother Andra Ebert and daughter Morgan Ebert. Thank you for joining me today. My listeners will hopefully want to get a copy of this and maybe even share it with their school library. How do they do so?
They can go to Archway, obviously. They can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They're all carrying it.
Do you have a website yet that they can access, or is that in the future?
Yes, winniethemininhorse.com.
Excellent. Understand you have another story almost completed and almost ready for presses, so we look forward to talking with you about that in the future. And listeners, if you're looking for them online, the last name is spelled E-B-E-R-T, so you can do a search there and find out about Winnie the Mini Horse. And again, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Do you ever wonder if you're the only woman who runs errands in her yoga pants so it will look like she went to the gym? Or how about the only mom who feeds her kids raw cookie dough? Or are you the only one who cooks her family cold cereal for dinner? Do you need more laughter and less loudness? More self-love and less self-loathing? More joy and less judgment? You're not alone. Come to the living room, a place where we get comfy, candid, and confident together. Come seeking sanctuary and leave feeling renewed. We're saving a seat for you. Give yourself some living room today.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book title is Discovering Your Own Doctor Within. And joining me is the author, Dr. Amy E. Coleman. Dr. Coleman, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Jay.
Dr. Coleman, this is a book that is a short read, 100 and so pages, just around 100 pages. There is a curiosity about it because it's not necessarily a medical book in its entirety. How would you describe the book and why it was written?
Actually, it's a culmination of patient stories, the real patient encounters that I gathered over the course of about 4 years. During that time, I was working in many different types of clinics. I was working in occupational medicine clinics. I was doing some preventative medicine work. I had helped out some corporate medicine. I was just out of the Air Force, you see, and I was just learning a little more about what the civilian sector, as we call it in the military, or the outside world, had to offer in medical care. So I was really working at these different places as an independent contractor and getting to know what is available to patients, what kind of experience do they have. So I had a great, I would say, range of different types of patients during these encounters. And it was really striking because in the military, as a flight surgeon, I learned basically that taking your time and letting a patient tell their story and gaining trust and being a part of the team, which is the doctor and the patient, is crucial to the outcome of the patient's health.
Absolutely.
And, so that's something that you really don't learn in medical school. At that point in medical school, there's, 4 to 8 years of training after college. You know, you're basically trained to be an external hard drive. Your mind is the most important thing that they want you to, they absorb facts and then regurgitate them on tests. And it's really a wonder that we don't find more of the humanity of the compassion between what is the relationship of a doctor and their patient. So this book is the culmination of those stories, which are real patient encounters. And it shows how just what I call the art of deep listening, or really being present with someone, can oftentimes get to the root of a problem, which may not be identified by labs or CAT scans or MRIs or referrals to 3 different consultants or specialists. Sometimes getting to the root of just being present and listening deeply can reveal so much that's even common to humankind as a whole and not just that one patient that you're seeing.
Dr. Coleman, the stories that you've recounted in your book, they're relatively brief. They're not long and involved, and they don't deal necessarily with the medical side. They deal a lot with the emotional side of responses. Would that be a right way to describe that?
No, actually, I feel like health is a conglomerate. Your health is not just your physical body. Your health is very much your mental processing of what's going on around you, and also how that mental processing affects how you feel about something, the meaning that you give to it. So, and with that is what we call the soulful or the emotional side.
Yes.
So, and with that, you have to understand that every part of it is linked to how you feel. Like there's an old saying that it really doesn't matter what happens to you, it's the value you give to it. It's the energy that you bring to it that can create whether it becomes the best thing that's ever happened to your life or the last straw that breaks the camel's back.
Absolutely.
And they can be the same exact thing for 2 different people, and they can see them in exactly different ways.
Your first,
absolutely opposite ways.
Your first story deals with a young man who had a heart condition, if I understand it, or his dad did, and he had a death wish. And how did you approach that? What was it that made a difference in his life?
What was it that made a difference in his life in that visit, or what made it a difference in his life as he went on after the visit?
I would say that you gave him some instructions or some ideas that perhaps changed his outlook.
You know, I really don't know what happened after the visit because I never saw that gentleman again. But I trust in just sowing seeds, in actually giving patients a bit of wisdom or even just a different experience. Because to be honest, a lot of times when we're living our lives, we're thinking the same 10 to 20 thoughts a day, so far as the ones that stay with us. And the experiences that we have seem to be similar in many instances. For example, in that particular story, the gentleman said that he'd never seen a doctor more than just a few minutes and was always rushed, and that he never felt like anybody was really listening or cared at all.
Mm.
And just a simple idea that he could have a different experience with the visit that we had, you know, maybe planted a seed that he could get help somewhere else, or that he could actually trust in the medical profession to maybe go on and reach out for other care in other instances. He had closed a door, in other words, and I was attempting to allow him to open one in the future.
Beautiful. And the title of that chapter is The Power of Prayer. You've, in Chapter 2, The Hidden Psychology, Chapter 3, Blessings in Camouflage. Which of those stories do you think is going to stand out to the reader and maybe influence them a way that you had intended?
You know, I think each reader is going to find a story that resonates with their own story. And I think that it's going to be difficult to make a decision in that, because everybody comes from a different place in their life. And everybody is bearing a different cross or battling a different battle. You know, there's a saying, don't ever be too hard on somebody that's in front of you, because you never know what they're dealing with in their life.
So true.
And these stories where someone comes up in front of me that may look like a very strong individual, like Blessings in Camouflage, which is about a CEO, very strong, commander of a military, who is now a medical director, that he could actually be experiencing the same type of anxiety that somebody who may be seen as a nervous type or a weak, you know, feminine type, or however you want to see it, or however society wants to deem it. Part of these stories are to show that we all can feel the same way, and so not to judge ourselves when we have instances of imbalance.
Dr. Coleman, have you always been a journaler? Do you journal often, mm-hmm. or is that something that you have picked up later in life?
I was always a journalist. That's actually the wrong way to use that word.
It is
a journalist for me is just writing and sketching and drawing, putting down my thoughts. And that's always been something that's been key to me understanding what's going on around me. So I guess it's one of those hobbies that just never left me.
What is it that you want readers to take away from your work? This, again, is called Discovering Your Own Doctor Within. That's a provocative mm-hmm. title. What is it that you want the reader to discover from reading your book and your accounts?
That's a great question, Jay, because discovering your own doctor within is understanding that sometimes the answers of the problems that you have come from looking inside of yourself. For some people, that's just spending a quiet moment in nature where your mind can come still. And for some people, that's meditation. For some people, that's prayer. Or for some people, that's going to talk to their 90-year-old grandmother on the front porch in a swing and just letting like the rest of the world fade away and seeing something from a higher perspective.
Mm.
And so seeing something from a higher perspective is actually part of each one of us. Each one of our responsibilities for the other person, because we're, you know, that's what friends are for. And when I see patients, I really see them as my friends. I feel a responsibility to help them reset the way they see the world. And I believe in doing that, it would be as if somebody on the phone you were talking to, a best friend, kind of saw that you were down and would do the same thing. So the difference is, you know, have a lot of information that I've stored in my left brain so that mm-hmm. if we get to an intersection that requires or needs medical intervention, then I'm ready and willing and able to give it. But I see medicine as so much more than that. And Jay, it's such an important time for this to actually be recognized.
So true.
Because we're getting ready to go into a whole new level of exponential technology, which brings in artificial intelligence and many types of things that people only seen in futuristic movies. And in artificial intelligence, basically that means that information is available to us all. Pretty soon, just a basic American person is going to have access to all of the things we learned in medical school and residency through IBM Watson and other programs, where they can find out what they need to know intellectually. So in the future of medicine, if everyone has access to the same information, what is it that makes us truly human?
Mm.
And for that, it's truly the compassion and the humanity. So that's what we need to bring to the forefront now and make that our biggest endeavor.
Would you also hope that maybe the stories in your book might also make it to those who are medical professionals and maybe influence them in a positive way?
Oh, most definitely, Jay. I have some mentors, and I have some colleagues, and I have a lot of friends. And they're doing research in some extremely valuable places for medicine to go forward in a new way that kind of redefines it for people. And we're seeing that there are differences that are made that medicine just can't quite get to. So there's ways of feeling better and healing or correcting a problem that, you know, aren't based on pharmaceuticals. And those therapies, they come at a cost because there's side effects. And with this, there's no side effects. So I have a lot of my colleagues that are backing me. One of my colleagues, Dr. Jeffrey Rediger out of Harvard, he's doing a lot of research on similar types of medicine that is in line with my approach to this book. So he's done a review.
Beautiful.
And that review is available, you know, when you go to check out the books to buy it. And then there's another Dr. Robin Youngson, who's an anesthesiologist out of New Zealand. And he's actually was so despondent about the type of care that patients were getting that he saw. He created a whole foundation called Hearts and Healthcare. He's traveled around the world for 10 years and given lectures on how important compassion is in medicine. And so this book is just, I suppose, another type of how to look at it that way.
Beautiful. This is your first book, is that correct? And if so, are you planning to do a sequel?
Actually, yes, Jay, this is my first book. It's a labor of love, and I've truly enjoyed it. I truly enjoyed it so much that the next book I already have planned. It'll be a little bit of a different story. It's actually, it'll actually be the story of my time in the Air Force as a flight surgeon and how I learned the medicine that I've practiced today.
Beautiful. The book title again is Discovering Your Own Doctor Within. My guest has been Dr. Amy E. Coleman. Dr. Coleman, I have listeners who will want to get a copy of your book and certainly will enjoy reading this because it is an easy to read style of writing. Where can they get a copy of this?
Well, Jay, it's available on many different formats. It's going to be on lulu.com now as an ebook and a paperback. It's also available now on Amazon as an ebook and paperback. And it's available on iTunes as the same. And I'm very excited, Jay, that the audiobook is coming out in 2 to 4 weeks.
Incredible.
And I was actually the recorded voiceover for it. So I'm not a professional voice, but the fact that these stories were so close to my heart, it made a big difference. I just enjoyed reading it out.
Incredible. Do you have a website that people can connect with as well?
Yes, I do. It's at wellsmartservice.com.
WellSmart, let me just spell that out. WellSmartService.com. WellSmart.
That's correct.
Service.com, and they can also do a search under your name without being a predator and follow you and the next book that you release. Last name is spelled Coleman. Dr. Coleman, I appreciate not only the book that you have written, but also sharing your story with us today.
Thank you, Jay. My pleasure.
Look forward to visiting with you in the future.
Oh, me too.
For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.